The information presented is for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are not necessarily the opinions of any Daikin company. This information should not be confused for accounting, legal, medical, or other professional advice. Please seek advice from a qualified professional for any specific questions.
Welcome to the Accelerated HVAC Success Program. My name is Ben Middleton. I'm the National Sales Training Manager for the Goodman, Amana, and Daikin brands. Today, we are joined with Alex Ayers. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So you work for Hardy, and for all of those that are out there, can you tell us a little bit about who Hardy is and what Hardy does?
Yeah, so we are the Heating, Air Conditioning, Refrigeration Distributors International. We're the trade association representing about 450 wholesale distributors of HVACR products across North America. We have members mostly in the United States, but also Canada, and then now an entire Latin American division going from Mexico all the way down to Central and some parts of South America.
So what does Hardy do exactly for all of these distributors?
So as our trade association, my job is government affairs, but we also do everything from talent and training where we can help our members train new employees or increase, you know, sort of the education for their existing employees to retain the quality of talent that they have. We also do a great market intelligence department where they are looking at sales so that wholesale distributors can compare how is my business doing to the average wholesaler across North America or even in my region. And it gives them the data to know how can they improve sort of their business model to make sure that they're succeeding in this industry.
So you're goal or your role with the company is government affairs. Tell me a little bit about, there's a lot happening right now in terms of government regulation and everything related with the government. What are some of the hot topics that you're running into right now?
Everything that is dealing with HVACR anymore seems to be regulated, whether it is the furnaces, the air conditioners, heat pumps, incentives for an installation, it's all getting touched now. So I used to say that we were a highly regulated industry. Now we're super highly regulated. It is literally all parts of the industry are getting new regulations and new laws passed either at both the state level and the federal level. And so tracking all of that is what Hardy does. It's my job and those that work with me in government affairs do to make sure that we're knowing what is going on, how that's going to affect our member businesses. And when we can try and mitigate or oppose things that are going to hurt business in the future.
So it's been interesting since 2021. It seems like it's just been one regulatory change after another. We had the SEER change that ended up happening. And so that was a big shift within our industry. We've had some safety and consumer safety related changes that happened just this last year that we ran into. And now we're talking about refrigerants, and we're talking obviously about the IRA and incentives to help contractors make systems more affordable for homeowners.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just about every part of the business now is being regulated and talked about in the halls of Congress, or, federal agencies and state capitals.
So let's talk a little bit about the IRA. I think that's a big initiative that the federal government has put out there. And there's several parts to the IRA. Some of the parts have been enacted and are implemented on the federal level. And then some are going to be implemented on the state level. Mm-hmm. And those are being worked through. So let's talk about what are the components of the IRA as you see them right now?
Yeah. So within HVACR, there's kind of two big sort of incentive programs. One is on the tax side, whether it's 25C for your typical home AC system or heat pump and furnace. Then you have 25D if you want to get into geothermal. If we're talking new construction, we have what's called 45L. I'm throwing a lot of numbers at folks, but this is how we talk about them. And then in the commercial space, 179 cap D on energy efficiency within large commercial buildings. These are all new incentives, or in a lot of ways improved incentives under the IRA that make it so that we can afford more higher efficiency products.
One thing that's fascinated me is I remember a long time ago, there was actually this big tax credit that came out for the 95% efficient furnaces. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember any statistics from at that particular point in time or not, but it really felt from the contractor side like that drove a ton of business for HVAC contractors and there was a $1,500 tax credit that was associated with putting in a 95% efficient furnace. I talked to contractors today, and there's even more of a cash incentive available for heat pumps. But it seems to me like contractors have not been as engaged with this tax credit versus that one that was associated with the furnaces. Have you guys done any correlation or studies between those two? Because we talk about it being enhanced, but what are some of the challenges that you see, or what are some of the things that are the same, things that are different that you've noticed as we move forward?
One of our sort of frustrations with, in this case, 25C, has always been that the taxpayer doesn't really necessarily realize that they're getting the incentive until long after the installation has taken place. So that's not really incentivizing behavior. It's rewarding good behavior, but it's not incentivizing the behavior at the time we want it to. Mm. And so that's where we've been working with IRS to get essentially better official documents saying, here's how you as a contractor can share this document with the IRS seal on it so that the homeowner now knows, oh, there's this very interesting incentive that we can take advantage of. I think it's getting that sort of marketing out there is what our big step is to get this one to be as successful as that previous incentive.
Well, and I think that's been one of the challenges. A lot of contractors have said, I really don't want to be a tax consultant when I'm out there selling a system.
Yeah. No one wants, everyone would say, you know, I'm not your tax advisor.
Right.
Because there are certain hurdles to jump through. You have to owe taxes, meaning that you had to have paid in. And then even if you got a return back, you still had to owe something in order to take advantage of this. And so it's hard sometimes as the guy sitting there trying to sell it to judge the other person. Are you going to owe taxes?
Right.
When most people do. So it should be something that we should do more of, but they don't want to make that assumption.
Sure, because then there's an implied liability that nobody wants to take on when they get into it. So we were talking before we got on this about the Hardy website, and you were talking about some of the most popular pages that you have on the Hardy website. And I think you said the IRA is actually doing some interesting things compared to other things that you've got on there.
Absolutely. It was interesting getting the review of what is the most visited website or pages on our website recently. And one of them was the CEE levels to qualify for the 25C. We wrote that blog post probably 16 months ago, and it's still one of the top read posts. So it's very interesting to see that people are still coming back to it. To me, that implies that people want to make sure that they are getting the stuff that qualifies so that it's being installed properly at the right efficiency level to get the eventual tax credit when the taxpayer goes and files taxes. And again, that's part of the hard part. You're filing that if you're filing in April, it was probably 8 months later than when you actually had the system installed.
Yeah. And so, I mean, obviously there's documentation that the homeowner is going to need, and you want to make sure as a contractor that you're getting that homeowner all of the proper assets and tools that they need so that your office is not swamped when tax season comes and everybody's saying, hey, I need this documentation so that I can get my rebate that I'm looking for.
Yeah, especially when one of the things we did this past year was looked at how do you actually fill out the form? And the IRS, I don't think they've ever seen an HVAC invoice. They didn't realize that they don't separate labor from parts cost on the invoice. But that's something they're going to ask you for on the form. And so, you know, probably going to see a lot of contractors as they learn more about this and are giving information to homeowners that the homeowner is going to request they separate that out for this tax form. And that's, you know, you don't want to be getting that request on April 14th.
Right. So that's the rebate side as we look at the IRA, but there's also, I mean, I'm sorry, that's the credit side of the IRA that we've talked about, but there's also a rebate side that we have to look at when we look at the IRA. I believe New York is the first state that has actually put kind of some, a program together, and they're still in the process of trying to figure out. But can you share a little bit about, you know, what New York is doing and then what you're hearing maybe from other states as they're looking to go forward with this?
Yeah. One of the big things that we were excited about when IRA passed in August of 2022 were these home energy rebates. They're two separate programs. One we generally call the heat pump program. Really, it's called the home energy and appliance rebate or HEAR. The other one, the homes program or home efficiency rebate, where for whole home, not specific to heat pumps or not really specific to HVACR, but whole home energy efficiency. We've seen a lot of states apply for both these programs, but really the first one that's getting out the door is the heat pump or the HEAR program. New York is the very first one to have their program roll out. What they did was they built it on top of an existing program called Empower Plus. And, you know, when it came out, we first thought, you know, over a year ago, oh, hey, the people that have these state programs, they're going to get going the fastest, should be really simple. And now we're finding out actually how hard it is to weave these programs together. New York chose to basically just plop theirs right on top of the existing one. So if you're in New York and are a low-income household, you can get $24,000 in rebates off a system. That's a phenomenal amount of money if you qualify. But it has to be installed by a qualifying contractor who has taken the time to apply to participate in the program. And that seems to be our biggest bottleneck right now. There's only about 200 contracting companies in the entire state of New York that are approved to work on this program. That's nowhere near enough. When we compare that to, say, Wisconsin, who is in the process of building their program, they already have more than 700 contractors and are probably 40% of the size by population. So, you know, it's vastly different when we're looking at how, you know, what are the hurdles to implementation. Having the contractor community participate is by far the largest one that states need to realize. And I think we're going to see people learning from New York's, misstep of making it too hard to become qualified as a contractor. And so the more you can open up that process, the more contractors can participate, which makes it easier for then the residents who actually get the benefit to get the benefits.
So what are some of those things that they're looking for a contractor to be qualified?
So there's two parts to it. One is the actual installation. They want NATE certified. We said, great, there's plenty of folks that have NATE certification. You know, the more certification that you can allow would be better, but NATE's a good first step. But they also want that same contracting company to do the home energy assessment, which requires a BPI certification. Mm-hmm. And there's just far fewer HVAC companies that have that BPI certification. And it's the requirement to do both. We would love to make it so that the person that does the home energy assessment can be separate from that installing contractor. And therefore, because folks that do home energy assessments can do them very quickly compared to the change out of moving from a furnace or a boiler to a heat pump. And so you can get a smaller group of home energy assessments moving much faster, while that installation process can be a larger pool of contractors.
Okay. So I think there's a lot to take in, but if I'm a contractor, I guess the big takeaway is probably make sure you get NATE certified if you don't already have NATE certified technicians as part of the qualification process, and then maybe potentially looking at the BPI certification in order to get prepared and get ready as we continue to move forward.
Yeah, and even if you don't have a NATE certified, if you can also get a BPI certification on heat pump specifically. And that also works to get you qualified on top of the home assessment BPI certification.
Okay. So great information when it comes to the IRA. I guess another big topic that we've been looking at is A2L refrigerants.
Mm-hmm.
What is interesting to me is I'm going out and talking to a lot of contractors, and I think we just did a survey and we found out that there's quite a few contractors that may be aware that there's a change going on, but haven't done a whole lot within their business yet to prepare for any of those changes that are going on.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting next couple of months as we start to see equipment make its way to wholesalers who, you know, will then distribute it out to the contractors for installation. You know, I was having a conversation earlier saying, you know, we think we've done as much as we can to help prepare both wholesale distribution and then the contractor customers. But until folks get the product in hand, we won't know everything. And so it's going to be, a very fun and interesting couple of months as we start to learn what is the differences that we didn't see. But, you know, I think we as an industry, we learned from our R22 transition that, you know, the more training we can do ahead of time, the better off we are. And so I think the contractors that took that time, learned those lessons, are going to be the ones that are going to succeed the most in this A2L transition.
Well, you bring up R22, and it's interesting. Many contractors that are listening to this went through that transition of R22 to 410A. How is this different than going from R22 to 410A as you look at this transition?
There's a couple of differences. One, if we just look at the availability of refrigerants, R22 had a lot of drop-ins. R410A does not. And so, you know, the supply of R410A is going to be very important in this transition. but then the equipment itself is changing. Moving from what's considered a no flame propagation, what we typically say non-flammable, it's not quite true, but it's pretty close, to mildly flammable is a difference. So understanding the sensors that are going to be required, making sure that folks are doing the right installation process. One of the biggest things that we've said is that if you are doing what you're supposed to be doing well today, you won't see as much of a difference with the transition to A2L. It's those same safe practices are going to apply whether it's an A1 or an A2L. But if you're not doing it well, that's where you're going to start to find some of the issues.
So the big question that everybody comes into mind when we talk about A2Ls, number one, we're not talking about an A3. We're not talking about propane or acetylene or something like that, or butane that's going into a system. We are talking about something that is mildly flammable, which I think there's some concern that gets raised with contractors. What have you guys seen in terms of safety and maybe where A2Ls are being used other places in the world?
The biggest thing is the idea that a flammable gas isn't the stuff we see on YouTube. It's not, you know, the big fireballs. We've seen videos of A2Ls being lit on fire in a room, and it moves very slowly because that's one of the required criteria to be an A2L. It has to burn at less than 4 inches per second. That's not very fast. You can walk away significantly faster than that. It also has to have a very low heat of combustion. The way I describe this is, you know, if you've ever tried to cook a hamburger over a campfire compared to a propane grill, it takes a lot longer over that campfire because it's just such a lower temperature. That's what we're dealing with A2Ls, is that low temperature, slow moving, and then because it requires a minimum, what's called the LFL, lower flammability limit, how much concentration of air to fuel that you have, once it gets below that, it self-extinguishes. Yeah. And so that's where a lot of our safety standards are built around, you know, we're staying well below that LFL, so it can never reach a point where it's flammable. Whereas when you have things like propane and isobutane, they're so much lower, if not essentially have zero LFL, they can always catch fire. Just doesn't exist with A2Ls. It makes them inherently much safer, but we have to still understand we are dealing with a flammable gas. Contractors are going to be having cylinders on their trucks of these flammable gases. So making sure that we're doing the stuff right, which doesn't take much, is going to make sure that everyone stays safe.
So I think you've been working with DOT a little bit too, talking about trucks and what happens as far as transportation of these. I think a lot of people are trying to understand, how do I need to change anything within my truck? What about my MSD sheets that I need to have? Do I have to put placards up on the truck with carrying this stuff around?
And the good news is, in some ways, we were already dealing with a hazardous material. The hazard was just different. The hazard was that it was a compressed gas. These are still compressed gases, but now we've added flammability. But the trigger points, how much can you have on your truck before it requires placarding? All of that stays the same. So, you know, if you are still below 1,000 pounds, which is, you know, if you have a full pallet, you're going to be below 1,000 pounds. You don't need the placarding. You don't need to have the hazmat certification. So a lot of those types of things are not changing. We are still working on what's it going to look like in the back of a contractor's truck. You are required to store it upright, when it's outside of its original packaging. An upright, is that diagonal or not? We're not sure, but it's definitely not horizontal right now. We'd love to see that changed because we don't want to see contractors have to spend a lot of money to redo their trucks. But for now, you'll have to keep that A2L cylinder vertical. But then when we're talking about transporting equipment, the great thing is the burden doesn't fall to the contractor, doesn't fall to the even the wholesaler. It falls on you guys, the manufacturers. Where they will get what's called a special permit that allows for the transportation of an A2L in the same manner as an A1 or with some other restrictions. So we can haul right now, if it's below 25 pounds pre-charge, which is virtually every home residential system, there's no restriction on how they transport it compared to the A1. So it can be transported the exact same way. When you get up into the big commercial chillers, we can get up to a couple thousand pounds inside of a chiller and be transported in the same way, as long as that special permit follows it. And the permit is applied for by the manufacturer or the importer. So the contractor really only has to make sure that, oh, yep, I have this paperwork with me.
Okay. So that makes it simple. I know you work, you said you work in Canada. You also work down in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Have you heard anything for those contractors maybe listening from Canada in terms of transportation or just A2L regulation in specific? Because that's been a little bit of a different story up in Canada.
Yeah, and that's where one nice thing is that the transport community is very international. They okay. do work together very well. And so I believe Transport Canada is doing the same sort of special permit processes that DOT is doing. Just don't remember exactly where we're at in those processes. So, but it should be relatively straightforward in the transport from the United States to Canada, and then once in Canada, following that same sort of procedure that we're using in the United States.
Is there anything a contractor should be thinking about specifically in terms of storing all of this stuff in their building?
Yes. This is something that Hardy has taken a lot of work on because we store huge amounts of refrigerant gases in cylinders. You know, we have members storing in excess of 100,000 pounds of gases in cylinders. That's quite a lot. When you look up the fire code and what a flammable gas is allowed to be stored, 300 pounds is not enough. And so working with the rest of the industry and a lot of fire code officials, we were able to get new amounts. We actually created essentially a new definition of flammable gas. We separated flammable gases from the traditional ones we think of, propane, isobutane, into what are called class 1A, and then we are class 1B, where the low burning velocity gases. And those have much higher storage limits as long as you still work with your local fire marshal to make sure they understand, oh, yep, you are storing it. You have to have a hazardous materials management plan, an inventory statement. But once they're aware of it and they have the correct code basically written down for you, you can store up to 20,000 pounds per control area in an unsprinklered building or 40,000 pounds in a sprinklered building. So, you know, if you are someone that wants to store this, please look up the proper ways to store it. But it's relatively straightforward compared to what we were worried about when it was just the single definition of flammable gas.
Okay. So talked about transporting, we talked about storage. Let's talk about just the basic in handling these refrigerants that are out there. Are there any things that a contractor should be, you know, concerned about in terms of the installation of this product? And so there's some standards, right, as far as square footage and gases. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. There's a couple of safety standards, ASHRAE 15, UL 60335-2-40 for air conditioning and 2-89 for commercial refrigeration. These all set up various ways of determining how to safely install a product. Is it need a refrigerant detection device that, you know, would evacuate the refrigerant from the room if there was a leak and issues like that? And those are all required to understand essentially how many cubic feet are in this room. Am I installing a mini split on the wall? Is it, how high on the wall is it? And that determines how much cubic space below that and determines what's the need for a sensor. Where's the sensor need to be? And every OEM is going to have a different requirement for that. A lot of them are coming pre-installed, which is great to hear. But making sure that, you know, even if you have a unit that can go both vertically or horizontally, how do I need to change that for a horizontal install? These are all going to be things where training becomes very important to understand and getting the right training for whatever product you're installing.
Absolutely. So, you know, we went ahead and released our 32 product, our ductless product, back in 2021. And one of the great things about it, at least our understanding, there's a rating of M1, M2. And so as long as you were under 4 pounds of charge within the system, there really wasn't anything we had to do in terms of mitigation of that refrigerant in our ductless product.
Yep, exactly. Because it required a lot more than 4 pounds to reach that LFL I was talking about earlier of flammability.
Right. But as we go into our split systems and getting out there, now you're going to have more refrigerant in a system that's going to exceed that 4 pounds that we have.
And a smaller room.
Correct, where it's going to be sitting in that mechanical room if it's sealed all the way around it. And so what are some of those mitigation standards that a contractor should be aware of?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different ways of how they can mitigate the buildup of this refrigerant. Most OEMs are using a refrigerant detection device that then tells the blower motor to turn on if it reaches 25% of that LFL. So using the 4-pound minimum size, for example, if it detected enough release, maybe it's probably less than a pound even to reach 25%, it'll turn on the blower motor. It disperses the gas throughout the ductwork and at a level that is not dangerous to the humans in the dwelling, but it prevents any sort of no amount of spark or existing flame could light it on fire that way. But there's other methods as well where you can use the compressor to move the gas within the system away until a leak can be found. But for the most part, we're seeing its dispersal through the blower motor. And that becomes then important in making sure you're connecting the sensor and the control board, not just to the new air conditioner or heat pump that you're installing, but if there's an existing furnace, making sure that you are properly connecting that system so the blower motor can kick on.
So with this sensor technology, there's also some new rules or standards that we have in terms of coils.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about, kind of these rules and standards as for the indoor coil that's going to be matched up with that outdoor system that would be an A2L. And our industry is going to be going to two different A2Ls. There's going to be 454B and there's going to be R32. So now you've got, in essence, you've got 410A. You may have some R22 systems out there still. You've got 410A, you've got 454B, and you have R32. So what does a contractor need to be aware of in terms of the coils and what they're matching up with outdoor systems?
Yeah. One of the things that the EPA has been very firm about from the beginning of approving R32 and R454B is that when a system uses that, it must all be all new components. So you cannot take an old R410 coil and now use it with 32 or 454B. It needs to have a new coil with it. If you install a coil that can use either 32 or 454B, it can never be converted once that refrigerant has been chosen. So, it's making sure that when you do the installation, if you have a coil that can accept multiple refrigerants, marking what that refrigerant is, and then it is that refrigerant forever. And if, say, something happens just a few years later and you're converting to the other A2L, you have to replace that entire coil. There is no reusing it. That's much different than I think we're used to with R410A, where you could maybe change the outdoor unit but leave the indoor coil. That won't happen anymore. It needs to make sure that you are consistent with what refrigerant is being used.
So those coils are going to have some sort of a sensing device in them to be able to detect if there is any leak. That sensing device, it needs to be plugged into something. And then whatever it's plugged into, as you said, it's going to then turn the blower on if there was a challenge or an issue that we had, right? So there are going to be A2L furnaces and A2L air handlers that will have some sort of a plug to be able to plug that sensor into. But then you're also going to have existing furnaces or air conditioners that would be a non-A2L furnace or air handler that's out there. There's going to need to be some sort of a board or device that can accept that sensor and then can wire in to turn the blower on that particular unit.
Yep. You're going to have to understand what that furnace is and exactly how to turn on the blower motor only without running the furnace or the air conditioner or the heat pump at the same time, where it's just that blower moving the air, but no other parts are running. So the compressor is not pushing more refrigerant out, because the last thing we want to do is add more refrigerant to a leak. And we don't want to turn on a furnace either.
Right.
So it's making sure that you understand what is the exact model that I'm working with and how do I only operate that blower motor. We've, from a government regulations perspective, we've never encouraged a regulation to require a full change out of the entire, if you think traditional HVAC, AC and furnace together. But it's definitely, with this transition, something to consider with that homeowner of, is it time for a more efficient new furnace that is more plug and play with the controls that are going to be existing with the A2L?
And I think this is really important as we look at the IRA going back to all of those incentives and rebates, because it comes back to affordability. There are significant, because it's not just the IRA, there are state incentives that are available as well. And so making sure that contractors are aware of all of the incentives that are available so that they can help a homeowner be able to do that full upgrade. But before we got on, you and I were actually talking a little bit about this idea of, you know, match systems.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some regulation or at least some conversations going on right now, if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So DOE has always, the Department of Energy, has always treated energy efficiency as a match of the outdoor unit to the indoor coil. It's not the full blower, it's not the full furnace, but it is the coil itself. And so when an OEM gets a energy efficiency rating, it's based on that match. And so the only way to guarantee the minimum efficiency is those two products together. And so when the R22 transition happened and we saw a lot of outdoor unit only replacements, DOE said, well, no, it needs to have a match, or we need to have a separate test procedure. And that's how we created the outdoor unit with no match test procedure. And now they are updating that again with this new transition. The test procedure itself isn't changing, but how they apply it possibly is. And so we do know that EPA said that after January 1st, 2026, you can continue to replace that outdoor unit as a service component. DOE is saying, well, it depends on what that indoor coil is. If it's an old enough coil and doesn't have a match in the database, they're going to have a problem with that. And so that outdoor unit has to be then tested to ensure that it meets it. And it's a lot harder test with this outdoor unit with no match, and could mean a lot of base model equipment, depending on how they apply the standard, would not be legal to install. And so we're trying to make sure that the test only applies to newly manufactured equipment that are meant for servicing only and not existing inventory, because we don't want to have something that there's been a lot of manufacturing and investment into that product to then just have to go to be recycled. We want it to be installed because it's the most efficient use of that product.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of uncertainty as to how this test is going to be applied, if it's going to be only newly manufactured or if it'll be equipment in inventory. And we won't, unfortunately, know until probably the end of 2024.
Okay. So speaking of the end of 2024, at the end of 2024, manufacturers have to stop making any 410A equipment. But Hardy, with a lot of other groups that are out there, have been petitioning the government. Mm-hmm. And so what is the rule going as we go into 2025 with all of the inventory that maybe distributors have and even that contractors have in stock? What are they going to be able to do in between 2025 and 2026, or even beyond 2026?
Yeah, and it really actually depends on what the product is you're looking at. And product, in this instance, actually has a very specific meaning. So when you're looking at package units, those are considered products. They will be, the manufacturers will stop making R410A package units January 1st, 2025, and we have 3 years to install that remaining inventory. But when we look at split systems, they're not considered a product. They're considered a system because they are installed. The refrigerant loop is finished in the field. That only gets a 1 year sell through. So it has to be installed by January 1st, 2026. Originally, it was January 1st, 2025. We all were freaked out going, oh, that's way too soon. We can't, there's no way we can get that done. And so Hardy worked with AHRI, which represents the OEMs. Another group called the Alliance for Responsible Atmospheric Policy that we're all members of, that we all work together to petition the EPA and say, hey, we need a fix for this, and we need a fix for this now. EPA essentially moved heaven and earth to get probably the fastest rule fix I've ever seen done. It was measured in days, not months and years like it normally is. And we are very grateful for them to help get that one extra year. But that does mean that it takes planning to make sure that we are sold out of all that 410 split system and product by January 1st, 2026. So then we don't have to worry about how does that DOE rule affect any remaining outdoor units.
Because I think one of the loopholes when we went from R22 to 410A was selling the outdoor unit as a service component.
Mm-hmm.
And that's potentially could be off the table depending on what happens with this ruling.
Exactly. But the good news is EPA and DOE are fine with fixing units. So there's always the ability to fix a 410 system. If the compressor is broken, instead of replacing the whole outdoor unit, it's replacing the compressor, the outdoor coil. You know, all of those types of components can be replaced forever. We don't want to force anyone to replace a system that still has useful life in it. There are plenty of systems that break and, you know, they need to be fully replaced. And those are the ones that will transition. We don't want to force anyone to transition early, because we know these units are getting expensive. That's why the incentives are so unpopular. used to be popular.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been kind of doing this fun little series that we've been playing with, Fact or Fiction, because I think there's a lot of misinformation that may be mm-hmm. going out there. One of the things that I hear a lot is, and I think a lot of it is just because historically, as an industry, we haven't gone with two refrigerants out into the field. It, you know, was R12 to R22 mm-hmm. to 410A, and now we're going R32, 450, 4B. Interesting, R32 is a component of 410A,
mm-hmm.
and it's also a component of 450, 4B. So in essence, almost everybody's using a little bit of R32, just they're blending it with something else in the different needs that they had in order to meet the regulations that were out there. But mm-hmm. one of the things that I hear is that with the AIM Act, they're going to be dropping down in 2029 the amount of refrigerant that can be produced. But I've heard that also means that they're going to be dropping the GWP.
Yeah. We have a lot of conversations about this because we hear it all the time.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we've done was we've asked the EPA, do you plan to have a second transition? And they will say no. The way this works is that they would only consider it if there is a petition to do so. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in proactively doing a second transition because they know how much of a burden it is on the industry and, more importantly, on the consumer. So the idea of a second transition in 2029 is pretty far-fetched. Now, we are going to continue to develop new technologies, and that doesn't mean that those won't be adopted more voluntarily. We've already seen that happen. You know, when we look at ultra-low GWP, some of the industrial gases or the natural refrigerants, depending on what you want to call them, they're being adopted today because they're highly useful. Most people don't realize it. When you go to, you know, a supermarket and there's that drink cooler right next to the checkout, it probably has, you know, about 500 grams of propane cooling it because it's very good for that purpose. And so we always want the industry to choose the refrigerant based on its end use, not necessarily based just on its GWP. And so, you know, that's where we do see there's various GWP levels for air conditioning, commercial refrigeration, and even within commercial refrigeration, 200-300 versus 150, based largely on how good is that refrigerant at its end use.
Sure.
So, you know, there's not going to be a government required transition, but we will, as technologies develop, see more transitions take place, just like we always have.
Yeah. And so the other thing is that I hear a lot, well, the reason Daikin's going with R32 is because they created R32 and they hold the patent on it.
Which no one has a patent on R32. It's right. Been around for a while.
Yeah. Been around since the 1960s. You know, what Daikin did have a patent on was they maximized some of the benefits of R32 in their compressor technology.
Mm-hmm.
But Daikin actually released all of those patents to the industry because they truly do believe R32 is a good, strong solution as we continue to move forward in trying to meet all of these challenges because of life cycle climate performance and looking at the whole entire lifespan of a piece of equipment, the amount of energy that's being used, what mm-hmm. it costs to produce the equipment and then recycle the equipment at end of life. All of those things you have to take into consideration when you're looking at a system.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, we do see manufacturers choosing R32 internationally.
Yep.
Just largely here in North America. It's been more of a split. Most folks are going with R454B, but it's their choice, again, more based on what do they believe is the best use of that refrigerant for its end use.
Sure.
So, you know, that's the choice that's been made. And I think there's going to be a lot of air conditioning contractors that are going to learn somewhat what the refrigeration guys went through last time around, where they did have multiple refrigerants, but it wasn't necessarily for the same end use. So they got used to that, you know, used to be when you would open up the back of the van, just all the different colors. It was kind of like opening a Skittles bag with all the different colors of cylinders, but it was for various end uses. Now we're seeing two refrigerants in the same end use. And that's where being, you know, well-trained is very important. What system am I working on? What is in this? Because we don't want to, you know, put 454B into an R32 system or vice versa. It's making sure that the proper markings are done at installation and that we're doing the right things throughout the entire service life of that product.
So Hardy's created some resource tools, right, for contractors. Tell us a little bit about those resource tools that they can access and they can utilize.
Yeah, we've spent a lot of time developing not only trainings for our wholesale members, but also tools that can be used by the entire industry. The big one is Ask A2L. Ask A2L is an online AI model that we have trained. We took all of our internal resources plus all the as many public documents as we can find from EPA, DOE, the various standards from AHRI. There was also the Safe Refrigerant Transition Task Force that developed a lot of public documents. All of those get uploaded into the model. It learns from all of those and then becomes a great way to ask questions. You know, when we talked earlier about the M1, so the level of refrigerant, if you know the dimensions of the room you're working on, you can ask, you know, at what level do I need a refrigerant detection device based on the size of this room? And it can do that calculation for you. And so it's having this tool, because there's just going to be a lot of small questions, but you need the answer very quickly. And so it's something that you can just simply pull out your smartphone and ask the question and get an answer right away instead of having to wait for someone else to tell you. And so we see this as a great transition device, as, you know, eventually the same way technicians learned the ins and outs of R410A, it just took a little while. Same thing's going to happen here.
So how does a contractor access that?
AskA2L.com.
Okay.
And so you can also find it on the Hardy website, but AskA2L.com. It's also a great tool that some wholesalers are starting to add to their own websites as well. So that way that, you know, for their own customers be able to get access, and if they can also expand on Ask A2L, where they can add some of their own data of, you know, what product lines do I carry, and have very specific data for that instead of what ours is general to the entire industry.
Okay. So that's a great resource. What other resources does Hardy have available that may be available for everybody if they wanted to go ahead and access?
Yeah. Primarily our HeatU platform, which is our training and talent development, is for HVAC distributors. But I do believe that anyone that wants to pay for the access can access it. So it's a great tool. If, you know, when we were talking about storage earlier, we have storage courses on, you know, what are the sprinkler requirements for storing X level of refrigerant? What is the transportation requirements? Knowing, you know, the various special permits that we were talking about earlier, and then just general HVAC knowledge as well. So it can get someone who maybe doesn't have much background in the HVAC industry very quickly up to speed, you know, from our point of view, working at a distributor, but in other ways, some other industries that also work with it can also benefit.
So I guess kind of to wrap things up, what sort of regulatory changes do you see on the horizon that maybe we can be looking for in the future?
The big one is the EPA's reclaim rule. It's going to come out early fall, maybe late summer, depending on your definition of when summer is. there seems to be lots of specific definitions talked about out of EPA when they say, oh, end of summer. Is that end of September? Is that end of August? What is it? But around that time, we're going to have a new rule on reclaim coming out. The idea is to increase the amount of recovery. The need for R410A is going to be there for a while because we're still installing products today that are going to last 15 plus years. So we need access to that gas. And the best way to have that available is to have more recovery of the 410 that's in systems today. That also has the added benefit of not releasing it in the atmosphere. It's the whole reason we're going through this transition. And we know there's just not enough recovery getting turned into reclaimers. And so it's getting that gas in the right hands, reclaiming it so that it meets the correct standard and can be reused in systems safely. So it's something that we're anxiously looking forward to, because there's going to be a lot of required uses for reclaim, we believe, in this rule. And so, you know, how do we make sure that we have enough recovery to get there? And so that's something that we're going to be looking at, of what's the next rule going to look like after that. That also helps increase recovery, because just increasing its required use probably isn't going to be enough.
Do you see anything in the horizon in terms of efficiency standards or anything else?
DOE has been on a sprint recently of efficiency standards, whether it is water heaters, commercial air conditioners, furnaces just came out at the end of last year. We do expect, because there is a test procedure on split system residential air conditioners, that there will be a rulemaking eventually, whether that's negotiated rulemaking like it traditionally is, or something out of DOE. We're not sure. That also probably relates a lot to who's running the DOE next year. But it's something that we're following. But the good news is when there is a DOE regulation like that, there's a 5-year time span between when the rule is finalized and when it goes into place. So take the furnace rule that was just done last December. That goes into effect in December 2028. And that will force manufacturers to stop producing anything below a 95% efficient furnace. But, you know, several years out, but it's something to be planning for of, you know, while there's incentives now, take advantage of those to install the high efficiency before it's the required minimum.
Yeah. Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us here. Do you have any last thoughts or comments that you want to share with our audience before we close this out?
I mean, I think the biggest thing is we try and get as much information out there as possible, whether it's the IRA toolkit that, exactly what we were talking about with New York. We have an entire sort of page on just New York. As more states come out, we're going to have more on that. As there are EPA developments, we publish that to our website. We want to make sure that there's as much information out there as possible. It's access to that information that I think solves a lot of the misinformation that we've been talking about, making sure that people understand what's the point of this transition or these incentives in accomplishing their goal.
Well, thank you so much, Alex, for joining us here. I really appreciate you coming here. And we look forward to have you on future episodes. For all of you that are out there, please, if you liked this episode, go ahead and hit that like button. Also, make sure that you hit the follow button so you can be informed of all of our upcoming episodes that we have. Thank you again, Alex, so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.